Welcome to The Bookshelf. Tonight, we'll hear the conclusion of A Key to Treehouse Living by Spokane-based author Elliot Reed. The novel is written in the form of a glossary-style list compiled by our young protagonist, William Tice, as he does his best to understand his uncertain world. In this final episode, we rejoin the story after William has run away from a bunkhouse for wards of the state, journeyed down the Missouri River on a homemade raft, uncovered the mystery of his missing father, and is now on his way back to the town where his journey began. Now, here's Trevor Rao, reading A Key to Treehouse Living by Elliot Reed.
Ultrapasse nemo obligatur. This is Latin for the idea that you can't be expected to do more than you are physically or emotionally capable of doing. It's a legal term, and legal terms are written in Latin because the judges and lawyers want to keep people who aren't judges and lawyers out of their conversations. If the law were in English, a judge would spend too much time explaining what he means to the people in court, and not enough time judging them. The good news is that you can get to his level if you know what to do. First, go to the library and find the section with law books. These books will be fat and heavy, will all look the same, and there won't be a lot of people browsing through them. Pick one out, flip to the back, find the Latin words with English translations, and spend some time trying to see if you can apply these words to hypothetical court cases against people you've met over the course of your life. Also, memorize a few phrases that seem general enough that they might come in handy in the courtroom one day. Ultrapasse nemo obligatur, for example, is a saying that could work in a number of situations. If you're trying to explain to El Hondero why you forgive him for walking out on you, for going solo on his wild goose chase for Mica in Ohio, and you want to explain it to him in a way that makes it seem official and not too emotional, if you don't want to just say, "I missed you and I was mad at you, but I'm back now, let's be friends," you could just say, "Hey, ultrapasse nemo obligatur, man," and give him a high five. And that'll make everything better. If your plan is to show up in court and try to convince a judge that he should go easy on your uncle, you'd better have some Latin in your back pocket so that you can sound official. Even better, go to the courthouse in a suit and a tie with a recent haircut and a letter you typed up on a typewriter and addressed to the judge. A judge likes having her letter hand-delivered to her when she's alone in her chambers, drinking a cup of coffee and looking over a case, especially if the letter is delivered to her by a reformed young ward of the state. Unorthodox methods. There is a method to driving a bus full of passengers. If the bus driver follows the standard method of driving a bus, he will most certainly get the bus from A to Z without calamity. His method will involve staying in one lane, not exceeding the speed limit, and restricting swerves. Not all bus drivers drive according to this tried-and-true method. Some drivers employ unorthodox methods. Some drivers attempt to drive while sleeping, while shouting angrily on a cell phone, and while eating enormous sandwiches that cause condiment spillouts on driver uniforms, curses on the part of the driver, and spastic corrections of the bus's direction. To write a story in alphabetical order is unorthodox, but if you're trying to tell a lot of stories all at once, and you're trying to tell them for a lot of different reasons, you must resort to unorthodox methods. Uneventful. If someone says, "How was your trip?" and you say, "It was uneventful," you mean to say that your trip went smoothly, that it did not include unpredictable events which forced you to change plans while on the run. A ride on a bus can be uneventful when, in fact, it was full of tiny events that weren't really worth remembering, but at the time were events of note. On my eventful journey down the river on my raft made of barrels, I was faced with rolling eddies, huge submerged trees, sudden mid-river waterfalls that would appear and disappear again in moments, enormous fish, a burning sun, mystical visions, and a shipwreck. On my uneventful bus trip back to where I'd come from, I was faced with a talkative office clerk who'd been visiting an old friend from college, a woman who ate two whole fried chickens, who sported huge fake nails which she sucked clean again and again, who nearly touched me with those nails as she made her way down the bus aisle toward the bathroom. I also experienced several strange naps filled with bizarre dreams from which I woke up sweating and disoriented. And that was about it. After I'd gotten off the bus, walked a mile to the old iron bridge, climbed up to El Hondero's little apartment and found him sitting in his chair poring over yet another map of yet another wilderness, and after he'd given me a peanut butter sandwich, sat me down in a chair and asked me how my trip had gone, First, I told them about the events going down there, of all that had happened in the town by the river, and then I told him the trip back had been uneventful. Uncertainty. It is for certain that everything is, ultimately, uncertain. A sentence that begins, "it is," could always be continued with the word uncertain, and this would, in any context, certainly be true. It has a bunch of people inside, and it is driving north on a road, and among the people inside of it is a woman who has eaten two fried chickens and who is now on her way to the tiny bathroom in the rear of it. Is it a bus? Yes. Though it is not certainly a bus. It could be a very long, specialized limousine. The purpose of adding an entry entitled Uncertainty is to resolve uncertainties that have, by this time, built up as a result of my private language. It is certain that I was traveling north on a bus when I saw a woman eat two fried chickens in quick succession, though she may have eaten more than two chickens. I say two fried chickens, though I am certain that the parts she ate would not, if you found and reassembled them, result in two whole chickens. And it is true that I became certain, after seeing her go into the bathroom, that I would not go in there for some uncertain but long amount of time once she'd come out. Of what else was I, at that time, certain? I was certain that I would, in a few hours, get off the bus, orient myself, and then set off in the direction of the bridge over the river onto which I had launched my raft of barrels. I was uncertain that I would make it to the bridge without being confronted by some new, unforeseen obstacle. An enormous ship could long ago have destroyed the bridge while trying to pass beneath it. Would I be run over by a pickup truck belonging to park maintenance workers on an off-road joyride as I passed through a city park en route to the old bridge? Unlikely, but also uncertain. I'd recently seen a man pop out his own eye and use it as a fishing tackle, see Sanker, which was one of the many things I'd seen recently that had taught me about the hazards of expectation, see Expectation. Would there be anything left of the old treehouse I'd built in the sycamore that one year it rained really hard and my uncle's basement flooded? That, too, was uncertain. And the thought that I might be able to resolve the uncertainty of the existence of treehouse ruins was enticing. Though, I put the possibility out of my mind for the moment because it is best to tie up your loose ends one by one. Unnaming. In theory, this would be to take a name away from something that has been named. If you can figure out how to unname something without renaming it, you might have discovered time travel. A dog that belongs to a hermit and has never seen anyone but the hermit will, when the hermit dies and the dog becomes wild, still keep his name, even if nobody else knows it. Vanity. A word for something that happens when you look at yourself in the mirror. Vanity is the obsession with one's image, an obsession that appears in the mirror when you think no one else is looking. I remember the subtle shift in Elondero's face whenever he caught sight of it in the mirror. He would stop, bring his lips together, and do something like a frown with his mouth. Though it was not really a frown. It was something else. The face he made in the mirror was a private expression, an expression he thought was secret, and watching it made me think of the privacy you get when you put your head in a body of water. The silence, the slowing of time, the loneliness of divers. I remember seeing my uncle catch himself in a mirror once, the mirror in the living room. He didn't know I was watching him. He was crossing the room when he caught sight of himself in the mirror. He stopped in front of the mirror, and a look of horror came over his face. He brought his hand to his mouth, as if gasping, and then began to rub his skin like he was testing how it felt. I don't know if there's a subtle face I make when I look in the mirror. Am I vain? Did I ever look into the muddy surface of the river, which was sometimes a brown mirror, and try to pick out my eyes and nose and mouth as shifting shades of brown? Did I make faces at myself for an hour in the water one particularly boring day? Can you ever shake your vanity? Soon after I was back from my journey down the river, I spent an entire hour at a thrift shop, trying on used suits and looking at myself in the mirror before riding the bus to Isabella's apartment. I needed the suit for the judge, not for Isabella, who had finished exploring her inner self in Mexico City. But about that, the suit not being just a little bit for Isabella as well, I am uncertain. Right before we left to go see my uncle in prison, Isabella made her mirror face in a mirror. She was standing in the dim hallway of her apartment. El Hondero was paging through a book on her coffee table, and I was standing there in her living room with my arms crossed when I saw her looking at herself in a mirror, making a face I hadn't seen before. Then she carefully put on a layer of red lipstick, smacked her lips once, and saw me in the mirror, watching her look at herself in the mirror. We made eye contact. My stomach dropped out. She stared at me for several seconds. I don't know what she was trying to say by staring at me like she did. Then she dropped her lipstick in her purse, snapped it shut, came into the living room, and we left. Visual aid. I once had a photograph my father took of himself. It wasn't a vain photograph, at least not in the usual way. In the photograph, he was outside the bus we lived in, and it was so windy his hair was being blown to the side. I remember he looked a lot like my uncle, and he was looking into the camera like my uncle looked into a mirror. Vortex. Swirling void, like an eddy, which sucks things into its center. A vortex can appear in all kinds of places. The only requirements for a vortex are the following. 1. It must be sucking things into it. Things can include you, a bunch of floating sticks, or even just your mind. I once saw a vortex and felt it suck my mind in. It was a cool, clear night. I was on my belly, lying on an old iron bridge, looking between its rusty iron beams at the surface of the water where the water was still, having pulled up on the bank where it was reflecting the stars and the shadow of the iron bridge, and the shape of my head looking into the water. 2. The vortex, to be a vortex, must remain a vortex over time. If, for instance, you look through the iron beams of a bridge at a spot where river water is pooled up on the riverbank and you behold a vortex there, you must be able to return to that spot where you saw the vortex before, lie down on the beams, and see it again. 3. A vortex, like a nexus, can be where things come together. A place can be a vortex, and so can a person. Vulnerable. The white flesh at the base of a turtle's neck, when it sticks its head from its shell, is vulnerable. Your skin, when it isn't covered in fabric and you're floating down a river in the blinding heat of day, is vulnerable to the sun. By night, to the mosquitoes. When someone shows you he's vulnerable, he's trusting you not to attack him. When you see that he is vulnerable, and he knows you can see it, you and he will become more deeply connected. For example, I once thought of El Hondero as something like a god. Then he showed me the scars his father had given him as a child. He lifted his shirt and showed me the scars on his back on that afternoon when I returned to the bridge. He showed me his scars and let me feel them with my fingers. Weary. When you feel you can't go on, but you must. El Hondero put his hand on my shoulder and said, "My boy, you are weary. Let me help you go on." It is easier not to be weary in company than it is when you're alone. Look at the guys who shovel gravel all day. If you've ever shoveled gravel, you'll know how terrible it is. No shovel is the proper shovel for gravel. Shovel gravel alone, you quickly become weary. Shovel gravel with people, take breaks with them, leaning up against the gravel truck, you're less weary. When you say, "God damn, it's hot," and another gravel shoveler replies, "God damn, it's hot," it somehow cools the air down. Wine garb. Good wine is properly had by sipping from a wine glass while you are wearing a suit. Good wine is for special occasions, like when you're reunited with your cousin, and it helps you talk to people if you're nervous and aren't sure what to say. Wine is better than beer that comes in big glass bottles because wine is fine even if it's warm, and because El Hondero and Isabella bonded over a particular bottle of wine that, evidently, they had both had before. Although I had my doubts as to whether or not El Hondero was telling the truth about having had this particular bottle of wine. Same as I had my doubts as to whether or not Isabella was truly a fan of the Dom Perota fresh leaf cigarillos that El Hondero always carried in the front pocket of his trench coat. It is best for you to leave and go find a park to hang out in if your cousin and your best friend are having a heated discussion about Bolivia, drinking wine and laughing at things that aren't funny, especially if outside it's nearing dusk and there's a bench you know in the park, and you've been meaning to write someone a letter. Wishing upon stars. It is written in a famous song that if you wish upon a falling star, your wish will come true. This is not the case. You make your own wishes come true, and besides that, it's all luck. Maybe if you wish upon a star and believe that your wish will come true, you will find whatever it takes to keep waiting for long enough. And then, eventually, because you've been patient, luck will come your way and help you out. It won't really be the star that helped you, but in the end it won't matter if you tell yourself it was. Luck is luck. Maybe there's more to it than that. Maybe it is the stars. Maybe I accidentally wished upon one once. Maybe I wished upon one and it traveled millions of light years to come and help me. Maybe it was what guided Sabi Juarez my way. Or maybe it was why El Hondero stopped me from getting into the water beneath the bridge that one night. Wonder. The explorer, hacking his way through the jungle, hears his machete ping against rock and finds an enormous granite statue swallowed up in the vines. He falls to his knees before the statue, joyful and in awe. This is wonder. Floating slowly down a river at night beneath a starry sky and a crescent moon, the hill's dark curves moving against the lighter darkness of deep space, the Seahorse Nebula, all the sounds of animals and insects coming from those hills, a thin swarm of lightning bugs flashing over the soggy bottomlands at the feet of the hills. This is wonder. Wounds. The healing and reopening of. A wound is a physical injury that doesn't necessarily kill you. A broken tailbone, sustained after falling out of a treehouse, can be classified as a wound, as can rope burn or a dog bite. Wounds can also be emotional. Your heart can be wounded, and it can feel like it's going to kill you. Imagine you find out your friend has changed the treehouse password and won't give you the new one. That's going to wound you emotionally, and you may want to wound your friend in return. But it's best just to leave. Wait, and let your wounds heal. Imagine your guardian, the person on whom you rely for food and shelter, the source of your basic living requirements. Imagine he burns down the house you live in, gets put in jail for arson, and becomes completely unable to help you in any way. You will be wounded. This wound will take a long time to heal and will maybe never finish healing. If you're sitting in a car with El Hondero and Isabella, and the car is parked outside a big, ugly building with barbed wire around it, and a sign that says, Schiltz Center for Reforming Adults, and you know that inside that building is your uncle, your cousin's father, the guy who hurt you both so deeply, and you'll decide whether or not to run the risk of seeing him. Seeing him could deepen the wound he made, or it could heal you. If you finally decide to go in, you should go through the jailhouse gate alone. Witness. In a court trial, the judge hears a story. Based on this story, he decides what to do with the main characters. The main characters try to make the judge do what they want him to do by telling their sides of the story. When a character tells a story in court, he becomes known as a witness. If you are going to be a witness, you will want to have witnessed something related to the story that the judge is hearing. Preferably something big, something meaningful, something that the judge will be moved by emotionally. See, overboard, going. Your story must also be believable. You will want to walk into the court with facts. You will want the judge and everyone else in the court to know exactly what you mean when you speak your language. Withdrawal of charges. This is when you've done something illegal and go to court as a defendant and stand trial before the judge. And then, all of a sudden, the plaintiffs stand up and yell, "We withdraw the charges." In movies, this happens because a star witness shows up out of the blue and is able to make plaintiffs change their mind by telling an amazing story. A story that shows you didn't really do the illegal thing that everyone says you did. And then the charges are withdrawn, which means you can go free. This is a thing that only happens in movies. This is a thing that does not happen if you burn down your own house in order to collect insurance money and you've admitted it. If you're charged with arson and insurance fraud, nobody stands up and says, "We withdraw the charges," no matter how moving or amazing a story the star witness, who has shown up out of the blue, tells. The mansion was worth money, and money is worth more than everything to some people. Work release program. But they can let him go on a work release program. The judge can let him leave jail for a day here, a day there, first to shovel gravel, and then the judge can decide to loan him out more permanently so that he can help you build a special library at a bunkhouse for wards of the state. You will have proposed the library in a document addressed to the judge and to Wilson Carmichael. Your uncle is an excellent candidate for the position of bunkhouse librarian because he has experience. In his mansion, He once kept a vast trove of reference material that he single-handedly kept meticulously organized, although they were, unfortunately, destroyed in the blaze. He is also an excellent candidate because the men on the gravel team will, once they've seen him shovel, vouch for his work ethic. Finally, your uncle can bugle the reveille at the bunkhouse every morning. If your uncle is good at all these things, which he will be, the judge might let him go free a little early, and you will have a place to live again. Xylophone, homemade. Of all the tone-producing percussion instruments, a xylophone is the easiest to make at home. All you need to do is find chunks of flat metal, attach them to a hollow wooden box, and bang on them with sticks or mallets, or even just your knuckles. Different metal pieces produce different sounds, and the wooden box that the bars are sitting on amplifies the sound they make when you hit them with mallets. When I at last got the chance to see my uncle in the Schiltz Center, I beheld a homemade xylophone. A guard let me into the common area of the prison. Isabella and Elandero were waiting in the car outside. In the common area, I saw him at a little table by a barred window, looking outside at the thunderclouds that were rising up in the distance. I guess he didn't get many chances to look out windows in prison, because he was so fixated on those clouds that he didn't even notice me enter or respond when the guard yelled his name. Around us, at other little tables, other inmates were meeting with their families. I was too nervous to go over to my uncle at first. I stood there, frozen at the door, thinking all of a sudden that I didn't want to be there, that I didn't want to meet him. Then I heard the sound of a mallet hitting a homemade xylophone over and over, someone playing out the notes of a song. I found the source, over in the corner, at a table. An old man in jail clothes sat across from a young man my age. Between them on the table was the xylophone, which the old man had made himself and was hitting with mallets. It was obvious that this old man had worked for many hours on the instrument and on perfecting the song, and that he'd done it all in preparation for this moment. I thought about my uncle's bugle. I pictured it buried in the ashes of his mansion. That's when I walked over to my uncle, who was still lost and looking out at that sky, and sat down across from him. Yonder, the wild blue. What my uncle was looking at out the window when I sat down across from him at the little table in the jailhouse visiting room. This wild blue yonder is where I was headed when I launched my raft. This wild blue yonder is where characters go at the ends of books. We say you've gone into the wild blue yonder when you disappear over the horizon, and we don't know exactly where you're heading. We do know that wherever it is, it's over that horizon in the yonder, which, if I'm watching you pass into it, is blue. And it looks like you're walking into the sky.
That concludes our reading of A Key to Treehouse Living by Elliot Reed. You've been listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. This episode was produced by Magdalena Clough and me, Chris Massini. Executive producer of The Bookshelf is Vern Windham. Music in this episode was by Dr. Turtle. You can find the full recording of this and many other books read here on The Bookshelf online at SpokanePublicRadio.org.